Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If people coming over here and migrating, they obviously want, like, to change their life. I feel like us as citizens, we should just try to help them. They didn't come here for no reason.
Regardless of how New York and Eric Adams try to deal with the crisis, our policy and our immigration system, it's terribly dysfunctional. It hasn't been updated since Clinton was president. If that system isn't dealt with, we're never going to be able to make significant progress.
I just think the mayor hasn't done anything for anyone, nor do I see them doing anything for the migrants. So
on top of housing, it's residents. How do we house the migrants who come here?
You can complain and want them gone, but they're not going to leave. So we might as well, like, offer them better solutions and allow them to give their children a place to call home here in New York.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Welcome to the show. People who responded to a recent Gallup poll say they are most likely to rank immigration as the country's largest problem. Not inflation, not housing, not healthcare, not even a collapsing democracy, but immigration. That's 28% of respondents. And so, last week, President Biden and Donald Trump each staged dueling photo ops at the U.S. border with Mexico. Both men went to Texas, President Biden in Brownsville, Trump in Eagle Pass, where he was joined by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. The governor has successfully turned Eagle Pass and Texas generally into a national symbol for politicians who argue, in his words, that the United States is suffering under a, quote, invasion of migrants from Latin America. And indeed, people who have crossed the border seeking asylum have been met with a mixed welcome as they have landed in cities around the country. Their presence and the challenges they present for local government have caused real tension in northern cities led by Democrats who typically celebrate immigration. Now, we have to say that feelings do very often outpace facts when we start talking about migration in the United States. So this week, we're going to talk to reporters around the country who have been trying to establish the facts of what's happening in their cities and in this country. And we're going to start with El Paso, Texas. I'm joined by Texas Tribune reporter Oriel Garcia, who is based in El Paso and who covers immigration. Oriel, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Speaking of facts, can we start with just, like, how many people are actually coming through the southern border at the moment? I gather that the U.S. Border Patrol reported a record high number of encounters at the end of 2023, but there's been a dramatic decrease. So is that correct? And just how do we understand the volume of crossings right now?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people coming across, or I should say more, they're being apprehended by Border Patrol agents. And yes, as you pointed, January saw the fewest number of apprehensions at the southern border by Border Patrol agents in years. So, but these migration patterns ebb and flow. But when we're talking about the number, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people.
What is that switch about going from a record high to a record low at that quick of a time period?
Yeah, I mean, ever since the Obama administration, these ebb and flows have changed depending on the political climate of some of these Latin American countries and the Caribbean countries, right? So, and at the same time, people who smuggle migrants or migrants themselves tend to be on the lookout on American immigration policy, mm-hmm. you know, over the past 6 years, 8 years. There's been different administrations have implemented different immigration policies that affects the ebb and flows as well.
Right. So it's fair to say that the month-to-month up and down is statistical noise. Don't worry about that. The point is, it's a lot of people.
Right. I mean, January saw the fewest number, but that doesn't mean that come, you know, May, we're going to see an increase.
Right, right. El Paso has been a center of migration for a very long time, and it's been largely welcoming of that fact as a city, right? I mean, what are there systems in place there that has where you have such a long history of ebb and flows of migration?
Right. I mean, I know we're talking about the contemporary times of migration, right? But I mean, El Paso historically has been a city where people come through. It is literally in the name in Spanish, El Paso, right? So El Paso is used to seeing people coming through here, whether it's in modern times or in historical times. But the point being is that currently now, elected officials in the city have been pretty welcoming, at least in the rhetoric, right? There has not been talking. They have not described them as invaders or a nuance to El Paso communities. That's not to say that there are issues, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lack of underfunding in NGOs who need to find shelter space for migrants. Border Patrol agents are overwhelmed with dealing with hundreds of thousands of people that they need to process. Mm-hmm. But the rhetoric is a little unique here compared to what the governor of Texas has been saying.
Right. And that local rhetoric, you think that is a consequence of the history, that this is not a new idea?
Right. That's correct. I mean, I think people here recognize El Paso has, like I said, been a crossing point for decades, a few hundred years now. And so people accept that and realize people are going to come through here anyway.
Yeah. And to be clear, right now we're talking about people who are seeking asylum as opposed to coming in search of work or family reunification or other things that have driven migration in the past. Is that a correct distinction for us to make? And if so, why is that an important distinction?
Generally speaking, yes, it is an accurate way to describe it, but it's very nuanced, right? I think something we should note is that not everybody who is coming to the U.S.-Mexico border qualifies for asylum. At the same time, there are people, a lot of migrants who do qualify for asylum. The issue here is the system of asylum and the process of going through asylum is very, there's a lot of government bureaucracy that makes the issue much worse and much more concerning. Right. But generally speaking, we're talking about people who are fleeing circumstances that include economic necessity, but political corruption, violence, and in some cases, the effects of climate change.
Right. And, you know, it strikes me, thinking about the politics of it, that one thing that Texas state Republicans have done successfully from a political perspective is just, you know, pick all of these fights with localities around the state and the country. El Paso is a place that's happened. The state attorney general, Ken Paxton, is suing the biggest migrant shelter, one of the biggest migrant shelters in El Paso, Annunciation House. What is Annunciation House and what is the problem that the state has with it?
So Annunciation House, it's a nonprofit organization that has focused on providing shelter for migrants and homeless people in the area. And it's not necessarily one specific building, but it's a network of shelters that's been in operation for 50 years and has worked closely with the Catholic Church in finding shelter. And most recently, there's been this wave of right-wing groups and conservative groups that have been attacking NGOs and have been looking to defund federal grants given to these NGOs. But what's most recently happened, as you mentioned, Ken Paxton sued Annunciation House because it did not turn over certain documents that the office was asking for. The director of the shelter sees that as a pretext to be able to shut down the shelter. Mm-hmm. So it's more of an escalation of what conservative groups have been doing to attack NGOs. Keep in mind, if the shelter were to close, it would create the kinds of problems that people who seem to be anti-immigrant are worried about, which is migrants in the streets.
Mm. And so to start taking apart the infrastructure that El Paso has had for a long time to deal with migration coming.
That's right. Those people who are advocates in around immigrant rights tell me that that's what they see, is that they want, it's an attack on the structure, like you said.
But politically, can you, and maybe this will sound like a naive question, Ariel, but why? I mean, it's one thing to pick fights with Democratic mayors, right, over the policy and the politics of it. But how is it politically advantageous to sue what is essentially a church mission, particularly in a state where I assume Christian voters are a big deal?
Right. I mean, and I think one of the issues is that the rhetoric around the way we've been discussing migrants has been to dehumanize them in a way, right? We call them invaders. We call them illegal immigrants. We call them criminal aliens. And if you're able to do that, people don't necessarily see migrants as equal to U.S. citizens. So politically speaking, if you're saying that you're going after organizations that help criminal aliens, politically, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it's the way we talk about it and the way politicians have been framing migrants, that they see if they're going after criminal aliens, it is politically advantageous to them and to their base.
Right, right. So once someone's not a human being, then that's a different thing. I'm going to play, we're heading toward break, but I want to play a piece of an interview you did with somebody who came to Texas from El Paso, and then talk about it. It's about 45 seconds and they're speaking in Spanish, but listen to this.
¿Te apoyaron? ¿Tu familia en venirte?
No, a mí nadie me ha apoyado. Dios, nada más. No, no cuento con nadie. Mi familia, mi mujer y mis tres hijos, nada más. No cuento con más nadie.
¿Pero apoyaron la decisión para que te vinieras para acá o no querían?
Nadie sabe.
Nadie sabe.
Nadie sabe que estoy aquí. Y menos que estoy aquí en el río de Piedras Negras. Nadie sabe, nadie.
¿Qué les has contado? Porque me imagino que has tenido comunicación.
Con mi señora, ahorita acabé de tener comunicación antes que se me dañara el teléfono.
¿Le dijiste?
Sí, que estoy aquí en el Río Bravo, que voy a pasar para el otro lado, le dije.
¿Y qué dijo ella?
Que Dios me acompañe, que sí lo vamos a lograr.
Before we head into break, just kind of tell us quickly, who were you talking to, and start telling us about their story, and we'll continue it after the break.
All right. I'll try to be brief. This was last summer in Eagle Pass. I was talking to a Venezuelan migrant who literally just crossed the Rio Grande, and he was walking in crutches. And I asked him, basically, does your family support you in coming to the U.S.? And he told me that his family didn't know that he was coming to the U.S. up until that moment in which he called his wife. And he broke down talking about what his wife's response. Mm.
We'll hear more about that story after break. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with Texas Tribune immigration reporter Ariel Garcia about the scene in El Paso, which is one of the cities around the country where migration has become a source of enormous tension. We can take your questions about both the new politics and the human need that cities are now confronting. You can call or text us at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. More about El Paso, and we'll go to New York and Chicago after a break. Stay with us.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright, and this week we're talking about the increasingly difficult politics and realities of migration as large numbers of asylum seekers have arrived in the U.S. and forced new debates in cities around the country. I'm still joined by Texas Tribune reporter Oriel Garcia, who is based in El Paso. And just before the break, we heard a bit of your conversation with a man from Venezuela who you met in Eagle Pass, Texas. Eagle Pass is, of course, where Donald Trump went for his photo op last week. It has really become a flashpoint nationally about the relationship between Texas and the federal government. What is going on in Eagle Pass? Why is that an important place now?
Right. I mean, Eagle Pass is a small town, mostly Mexican-American, of about 30,000 residents. It is on the right next to the Rio Grande. And historically, they've not seen the types of numbers of people crossing through there. And what has happened is that Abbott has sent hundreds of state troopers and National Guard members to Eagle Pass to apprehend migrants who are crossing the Rio Grande. And most recently, what he did is that National Guard members took over a 47-acre city park called Shelby Park. Shelby Park, like I said, is a city park right up against the Rio Grande. And when migrants cross, they naturally cross onto the park. It is the first among the first places they step on American soil. And taking over the park, they've enclosed it with concertina wire, not just on the riverbank, but along the edges of the park. And no one is allowed on the park without the permission of National Guard members who are patrolling the park. And that includes residents of the park, city officials, including Border Patrol agents. So Border Patrol agents would use this park as a makeshift processing center when there were too many migrants to apprehend at once. And so right now it's a very militarized park. I mean, you go in, you see Humvees, you see National Guard members with rifles, and of course, the concertina wire that I just mentioned.
It is from afar a bit of a terrifying scene to read about. I mean, it sounds like almost 1850s level saber rattling from the state at the federal government. And you wrote about how it's fed into the secessionist movement in Texas. Is that a real thing? I mean, you have been there, you have been on the site. How dire does this seem? I mean, there's the question of what's happening for the migrants, but also just about the larger breakdown of federalism, of the relationship between the federal government and Texas.
Yeah, I mean, some context here is that there has never been an escalating issue like this in American history between the state and the federal government over immigration, right? And so what some separatists have been talking about, we used to think about people who wanted to make Texas into its own country as a fringe talking point. But it is what Abbott is doing and going up against the Biden administration has inspired a lot of people thinking that this sort of rhetoric is being normalized or that it is a legitimate solution to immigration, the state separating itself from the federal government. I think ultimately, like I said, what is happening is unique. We haven't seen it. And it's, like you said, kind of terrifying to see. Just the eye test, going to this park and seeing National Guard members in what's supposed to be a family-oriented park. Ultimately, like I said, it's unique, so we don't know where this is going, but it's definitely inspired a lot of people who mm-hmm. believe in separating Texas from the federal government, or from the country, I should say.
Okay. Ariel Garcia is going to hang out till a little later in the show, in case we need to talk a little more about Texas. But I want to move our conversation north to two cities where asylum seekers who cross the border in Texas have been landing. I'm joined now by Arya Sundaram, who covers immigration here at WNYC in New York. Arya, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
And we can take your questions, listeners, both about the politics and the human need that cities are now confronting as the number of people seeking asylum has increased. And Arya, the word crisis has come up a lot for New York and for a growing number of places. But just from the top line of it, from your reporting, because it's often difficult to separate the political crisis from the actual reality. So in the broadest sense, is this, in fact, a crisis? And if so, how would you characterize it in New York?
Well, some people, there's a certain sect of society that would say the existence of the tens of thousands of migrants here is itself the crisis. But I think there's also, I think what others would describe as a housing and a budget crisis when we kind of get into the nitty gritty of the practicalities here. So with the tens of thousands of migrants that have come here, many are staying in the city shelter system. New York City has, unlike many other cities across the country, a right to shelter kind of series of laws and court mandates that require the city to provide a shelter bed to every single person here that meets certain minimum requirements, like they can't be too close together, the beds, for example. But as the city has had this influx of migrants, particularly asylum seekers who might not have familial or social ties or people in the city that they can bunk up with as other immigrants, new immigrants to the city have in the past, many have gone and relied on the shelter system, which has expanded it by threefold since January of 2022. And the city has rushed to open up a number of emergency shelter locations and places that shelters have not been before. So we're talking about hotels in massive tent cities that you see popping up on former air bases, other kind of ad hoc situations in old office buildings and commercial sites across the city. And the mayor has continued to say that the city is out of space. And there's been this question of what will happen moving forward, for sure.
Which is to say that unlike, say, you know, a crime panic or other things that have been where we've conflated politics and policy around the word crisis in New York, there is a true, and this is not manufactured, there is a real challenge, regardless of where you fall on how to handle it, which we can talk to about in a minute. The problem is real. Arya, how many people are we talking about in New York City? I mean, this city of millions of people in the first place. So what is the numbers of folks that have shown up that then put strain on these systems?
Sure. So since spring of 2022, there have been nearly 180,000 migrants that have gone through the shelter system. And now currently there's about 65,000 that are currently in the city's care. There's a question about where the rest of those folks have ended up, if, you know, in their own apartments, et cetera. And also that doesn't account for the many migrants that may come here and, you know, may not even go through the shelter system, but those are the numbers that we have right now.
Right. And it's a distinction. Again, I spoke about this with Ariel Garcia in El Paso. The distinction is we're talking about asylum seekers versus people who have come looking for jobs or family reunification. Why is that an important distinction?
Mm-hmm. So certainly a number of them are asylum seekers. As Uriel has pointed out, they might not all qualify for asylum. They're The folks that I'm speaking to are coming here for a variety of reasons, economic, political tensions, et cetera. But I think why it's important that these are asylum seekers rather than green card holders, folks, you know, new immigrants to the city that may be coming and reuniting with family members that have long been here, is that they lack the same social and cultural ties to the city that so many new immigrants have had. It means that they don't necessarily have a place to stay, for example, getting connected to services, getting a job, that all is so much more difficult when you don't have those familial and social ties.
Yeah. So, which means then now you are depending more on the public sector for those things.
Exactly.
Right. We had a text message from a listener who says, I live in Kingston, New York, which has been a sanctuary city for many years. I volunteer at a food pantry that caters to immigrants, primarily from Central America, but some from other places as well. It is a program that is part of the Olsted County Immigrant Defense Network. In the past year, we've seen about a 25% increase in the number of families we serve. The funding, however, has not increased that much. This is particularly hard in winter when donations of fresh produce from farms in the area aren't available. So Kingston is an area upstate New York. It's outside of the city. So we're not just talking about New York City, first off. And we're not just talking about a strain on public resources, right? How much do you hear what we're hearing from our texter in Kingston?
Absolutely. I've been hearing from so many food pantries, pro bono lawyers, churches, synagogues, mosques, the whole nonprofit apparatus of New York City, it feels like, who has felt the strain of the influx of new migrants with deep needs into the city. So, for example, there are a number of mosques, synagogues, churches I'm talking to who are sheltering many, many migrants right now. Food pantries, also that same issue is popping up of, you know, I talked to a number of nonprofits and churches who say that, like, already they were getting so many more people coming to seek their resources, and a number are particularly targeting and having to help migrants now who are in that situation as well. It seems like it spans across the system, not just food pantries, but also pro bono lawyers, for example, who have long been helping New Yorkers navigate various legal battles. Now they're seeing, an influx of migrants from this whole situation and also struggling to be able to help them.
Let me now bring in Adriana Cardona-Magigad from WBEZ, immigration reporter in Chicago. Adriana, we've got you now, right?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, wonderful. What about for you in Chicago? Similarly, I don't know if you've been able to hear what Arya is telling us, but the level of crisis, like versus political debate, but actual real challenge that migration in Chicago has presented, how would you characterize it? What is the core of it there?
Absolutely. So when we say crisis, it isn't so much that obviously, like, so many people are here coming, just looking for work and a better life. But it's the humanitarian crisis of having so many people who are not eligible to work and provide for themselves and may not have the financial means to really be financially independent. So that has created a humanitarian situation when you have thousands and thousands coming. So I'll tell you this, August of 2022, so we started seeing the buses arriving from southern border states, primarily from Texas. And right now we have about, it's an estimated of like 36,000 new arrivals, migrants, mostly from Venezuela and other parts of South America. And yeah, it's created a situation that Chicago had not seen before. Yes, we had an undocumented community here. We had about maybe somewhere around 180,000 undocumented people here before or around, you know, this last couple of years. But the situation with the asylum seekers has definitely kind of like changed the dynamics of just so many aspects of the city, including housing and even the schools and kind of like the Aria was explaining earlier in terms of like the shelter system. So when migrants arrive here in Chicago, they're connected to shelters and they get food there. And I will tell you, like, city officials and a lot of local organizations have worked really, really hard to really ensemble these shelters and open them and in almost kind of like a chaotic setting, because the buses just kept coming. And they, I believe, like, as of, you know, just recently, like, more than 800 buses like have arrived in Chicago from places like Texas. So in this situation, migrants are, they get here, they're not eligible to work, and they're draining on their own resources, and they enter the shelter system. And during the winter, in like around January, it kind of peaked. Like, we had like about 28 or 29 active shelters. That means like they were receiving people, and they were, you know, migrants were staying there. And now we have about 23 active shelters. So some shelters have been closing because not as many buses are coming. But when we saw a peak, it was a real situation. I mean, I remember before this crisis, maybe seeing, obviously, like, unhoused people on the streets. Very rarely I see a family with children. But unfortunately, with this crisis, it kind of became the norm, like, or like something that you see often. Like,
has that changed? How has that changed culture? I mean, is that something that has shown up in the conversation amongst Chicagoans as a consequence, if it's that visible?
Well, I think, like, it's a lot of mutual aid volunteers, and a lot of people are definitely just heartbroken by it. And they're really trying to help and to assist, you know, with all the basic needs that migrants need right now. Anything from food and clothing, and just connecting them to schools, and just so many other basic necessities.
But, so you see people rising to the challenge as opposed to becoming upset about their presence?
I would say for the most part, yes. But there's also been pushback. Like, you know, when city officials were trying to figure out where to put all these people and which shelters to open or what spaces could become shelters, there was pushback from residents who say, our schools have been under-resourced for years.
Right.
We've had an unhoused situation for years. We've had residents who've been unhoused for years. And what are the resources for them? And that's totally understandable.
We'll have to pick it up after break, Adriana. I'm Kai Wright. I'm talking with immigration reporters from New York, Chicago, and El Paso. And we can take your questions for our reporters. Call or text us at 844-745-TALK. Coming up, the politics of all this. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Regina, a producer here at Notes from America with Kai Wright. I hope you're loving this episode, and I know you want to get back to it as soon as possible. But before we get back to it, I need to tell you something. As you know, we cover a lot of issues and ideas on this podcast, and we don't want to do it without you. Having your questions, stories, and experiences in the conversation is so important to us. So let me tell you how to be in touch. In the show notes of this episode, there's a link that takes you to our website, notesfromamerica.org, where you can record a message for us. Plus, our inbox is always open at notes@wnyc.org. You can write us, or even better, record a voice memo on your phone and send it to us there. Again, that's notes@wnyc.org. I'll be looking there for a note from you soon. All right. Thanks for listening.
This is Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. I've been talking with immigration reporters Adriana Cardona Magigad from WBEZ in Chicago and Arya Sundaram from here at WNYC in New York. And Adriana, you recently reported on hundreds of complaints that migrants have filed against shelters in Chicago. Can you briefly give us an understanding of what it is migrants are saying is happening to them in those shelters?
Yeah, so many of the migrants I spoke with, and also based on these grievances, many have complained about the lack of treatment or the poor treatment from staffers at these shelters of the grievances that were filed within a six-month period. We found about 248 or close to 250 complaints or grievances, and 60% of those were involved staffers. And pretty much they say that the treatment or the hostile environment, some of them complain about being discriminated against or, you know, having staffers who use like maybe discriminatory language because of their, you know, their country of origin, but also, you know, their sexual orientation. And in this situation, migrants are very powerless. They obviously have to, you know, follow rules, and they have to, you know, live within what those rules, you know, are saying. Like, they have to keep a minimum amount of, you know, clothes and things that they bring to the, into the shelter. But there are other things where, like, you know, if they want an extra glass of milk for their children or like maybe an extra bottle of water, it just becomes extremely difficult. And especially too with, you know, food. We're talking about people who eat like, tell me they like to eat very plain food, and sometimes the food can be either very limited or they also see that they're being served food that, you know, like it has mold on it, or it's something that, you know, is making their children sick, or their children don't want to eat. And then the situation
do you get a sense that this is a consequence of actual strained resources, or just malice and neglect from the city or from the people running the shelters?
Well, I think that the one thing that I kept questioning is how trained are the staffers from the favorite healthcare facilities? The company is a Kansas-based company that was hired to run many of these facilities, these shelters. And I just wonder how trained are they in like de-escalating conflict, and also just treating people who've experienced a lot of trauma on their way here. You know, I mentioned one in my story, actually, the one that you're referring to. A migrant woman complained and wrote in the grievance that she went to get a glass of milk for one of her babies, and she felt harassed, and she wrote that she was forced and harassed into showing her breasts. And that night she went to bed crying because that kind of like gave her a panic of what she experienced on the road. So those allegations are serious. And, you know, when you have people with trauma, when you have people who are so tired, they get to Chicago after they like just went through the Darien Gap, they went through the border, they went through so much, and they have that power to go through all of that. And it seems like when they come to the shelters, that power is taken away in so many different ways. So I do question the lack of, maybe there is lack of training. The company says that they are trained, and the city says they don't tolerate discrimination. But I don't know. There is something that could be better there.
Nonetheless, people are experiencing it. Let's take a call. Let's go to Megan in Brooklyn, New York. Megan, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call. I just wanted to make sure that it was elevated and shared with listeners that in New York City, we don't view this as a migrant crisis in nonprofits and among social workers. What we who work with migrants, we know that this is not a migrant crisis. This is a fiscal management crisis. For example, $432 million is what I read in Brad Lander's report was given to DocGo, a remote medical company that was contracted by Mayor Adams to serve within the tent shelters at the margins of our city at Floyd Bennett Field, Randall's Island, the Creedmoor facility. And they did such a horrible job. It was such a scandal. Their CEO resigned. But this is not the only instance of fiscal mismanagement here. So the resources at nonprofits are strained because they have not been funded properly to provide the services. For-profit companies were funded to provide services, and they did a horrible job, and they continue to do a horrible job. So this is what we have to address. This kind of fiscal mismanagement is malice.
Okay. Thank you for that, Megan. And Aria, what about this? And so first off, listeners, Brad Lander is the comptroller of New York. So that's the person who sort of audits what the mayor is doing financially. And so that's the report that Megan is referring to. Aria, I don't know that we necessarily need to get into the details of Brad Lander's report, but this idea that this is a financial management crisis, not in any other kind of crisis.
Sure. And I think the term, I think the listener's reaction, your reaction was so emblematic of how the term crisis in New York City has, specifically migrant crisis, has become so contested, particularly because of the criticism of how the Mayor Adams administration has actually handled this situation. I think there has been increasingly a sense by the comptroller, so many local elected officials, nonprofits that I speak to, that the city has been misspending its funds, has been relying on, organizations, for-profit entities like .go, and spending outsized resources, billions of dollars on companies that are not really providing good work, that are overcharging them. And there's been this push in New York City to move the city away from these kind of emergency contracts that the mayor has been relying on to fund and manage this migrant crisis. Of course, the city is saying, we had to act rapidly, quickly to, adjust to this massive influx of people into the shelter system. We're trying our best. But of course, there is a whole group of local officials and nonprofits that are saying the city just isn't doing enough to move people out of shelter in other ways.
Let me bring back into the conversation Ariel Garcia from the Texas Tribune. Ariel is in El Paso. And I bring you back in, Ariel, as we start talking about the politics of this a bit. And I know none of you are political reporters, but nonetheless, everything that you're covering, we're hearing all of this detail about how truly challenging it has been in all three of your cities to try to figure out how to manage this influx of folks. And an election is coming in which this is clearly going to be a top line question and a top line debate. And politics is going to become part of it. And I'm wondering how you think about how that's going to impact what we're seeing. So I want to start with you, Ariel, in El Paso and in Texas, as the political season heats up, if you had a disaster scenario, I guess, of like how this is going to impact the actual effort to manage migrants coming across the border, what are you concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues here is that I'll backtrack here a little. And Ruben Garcia, the director of Annunciation House, the shelter we spoke about earlier, one message that he told me he wished people understand was, let's take a step back and remember that we're talking about human beings. And as Americans, we should question ourselves, how do we treat human beings who are in need of help, right? And so if the rhetoric right now and the solution is to continue doing immigration enforcement, it's not going to solve the issue. However, both candidates, both Biden and Trump, are proposing similar things, even though the rhetoric may be different. But the proposal has always been, how do we find ways to stop people from coming to the U.S.? It's never been about how do we help people coming to the U.S.? Mm. And I think that's a very distinct difference. And ultimately, I think how it's going to affect the election, I think, is whose ever rhetoric prevails more.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it's how it's going to affect the election, but I'm more questioned how the election is going to affect the people. and I guess I hear you saying that from both sides, you hear an intensification of this defining them as problems as opposed to people who we might want to help.
Right. I mean, even from that point of view, yes, if we're taking it from the perspective of the immigrants, whether they're following the election closely or not, is that ultimately what's going to happen is that regardless of who wins, like I said, the solutions that they're both proposing has always been enforcement and how to keep people out. And ultimately, I think what's going to happen is that it's only going to become harder to come to the U.S. legally. And that is something that we've seen in the past 20, 30, or 40 years. And my lifetime has just become harder to come to the U.S., not easier.
Adriana, in Chicago, someone sent a text message that I want to read you and ask you the same question in the context of this, because it relates to something you were saying earlier. The listener writes, in Chicago especially, why does it seem like the migrants are being placed in Black and poorer communities? Is it a problem that resources that were denied to U.S. citizens are suddenly available for non-citizens? So this relates to something you brought up a little earlier, but I'm thinking about it now in the context of an election year and in the context of heightened political rhetoric that comes into an election year. Chicago has a new mayor, Brandon Johnson, who came in a young, progressive, with lots of support. Is he someone who can thread this needle? How do you think that particular kind of politic that we're hearing described in that text message about, Black communities and poor communities versus new migrant communities is going to show up in the political conversation? And is Mayor Johnson somebody who can navigate it?
Okay, well, this is an extremely hard situation, of course. And I will tell you, like, in terms of, like, the bigger debate, it's being focused right now is, how do we make immigration harder for people instead of how do we help people come into the U.S., right? Right now, in the focus of Chicago, people, the migrants are being placed on the south side, primarily because, one, that's where you find, or south and west side, that's where you find some of the cheapest rents, like the monthly rent cost is extremely expensive in Chicago, right? Mm. When we're talking about how do we help migrants become financially independent? We're talking about, like, can there be a pathway to giving them some sort of, like, a work permit? And I know there have been some, like, the temporary protected status that prevents migrants from deportation while allowing them to work here. But at the same time, like, not everyone is eligible for that. So when people are saying here in Chicago that migrants are here taking up resources that should be going to citizens, those resources, like, if you talk to migrants here, they say, we are grateful for what we're, getting, but at the same time, we want to become independent. We want to work. We're just not finding work anywhere. I mean, we are not finding, we're not able to work. We're not, everybody's asking us for our work permits. So the mayor has a really situation in their hands, the mayor and the governor and, like, many, city officials. And, like, how do you stay away from, like, how do you handle this humanitarian crisis of people who cannot work and provide for themselves? And they are helping some people. They are giving some, not everybody qualifies for this either, but they created this a rent voucher program and to help people with several months of the rent cost. And it's a program funded by the state. Not everybody qualifies. The money, people are not having this help anymore, but for those who were able to get the assistance, yes, they were able to try to find homes or apartments in the places where they could actually pay for these. I mean, you're shopping for an apartment with a voucher, and you're going to go after the cheapest rent. And those cheaper rents are usually on the south and west side.
Are in Black neighborhoods. On the question of work, yeah. I want to play something. Arya, I want to play something that someone said to you. Here, this is, they're speaking in Spanish, so we'll listen to it, and then Arya can tell us what the conversation was about.
Si nos quedamos quietos sin hacer nada, entonces somos unos mantenidos, somos unas personas que estamos dependiendo del gobierno nada más, y si salimos a trabajar, entonces somos unas personas que están por fuera de las reglas y por fuera de la ley, entonces no sabemos, queremos solución.
So, who was that, and what were they telling you?
Sure. This was a man named Van from Colombia. We spoke last summer while he was selling fried plantains on a street corner in Jackson Heights. And at the time, he was living in a shelter in Manhattan with his wife and two kids, trying to make it as a street vendor. And what he basically was saying is that he feels like if he stays home, doesn't do anything, then we're just mooching off the government. We're depending on the government. And if he goes back to work, then he feels like he's operating outside of the laws because he doesn't have a work permit. And he's like, I don't know, we want a solution. But I just really feel like this conversation is something that I hear is echoed in so many of my conversations with migrants. They have this double bind where the federal government has allowed them to be here, but essentially made it impossible for them to work, at least for 6 months and oftentimes much longer after they apply for asylum. And on the other hand, many of them are aware of the politics around their existence in the city and in shelters and the rising like multi-billion dollar cost to care for them, the concern from other residents. So many tell me that like they don't want to depend on the government, but also if they're working, they are operating outside the laws too, and they just want a way forward.
Right. That's well, you've sort of gotten to the last question I wanted to ask you is just about how aware you think people are of the ways in which they have become the source of so much political and policy contention, how much that is part of their understanding of what's going on for their lives.
Mm. One of the most recent conversations that I had with a group of migrants actually living on a school bus in Brooklyn because they decided to exit the shelter system was about a string of recent crimes that have been tied to migrants in the city and this kind of political narrative about an unfounded one about kind of a wave of migrant crime in the city. And they were talking to me, they said, goodness, like we're worried that all of us are being lumped together as the same entities, that some individual bad actors are seen the same as us, just folks that are trying to make it forward, that are trying to, you know, do our best that and get a job.
Yeah.
And these kinds of conversations are happening all the time on WhatsApp groups, in, you know, closed doors of nonprofits, in so many different cases. And it sounds like so many of the migrants that I speak to, I've almost been surprised at how aware they've been of the contestation of their very existence in the city.
Arya Sundaram is an immigration reporter here at WNYC in New York. Adriana Cardona Magigad is an immigration reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. And Uriel Garcia covers immigration for the Texas Tribune. He's in El Paso. Thanks to each of you for your reporting. And thanks to those who called in. You can always talk to us, even when we're not live. Just leave a voicemail at 844-745-TALK. We are listening, and it helps us plan future shows. Notes from America is a production of WNYC Studios. Find us wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram at Notes with Kai. We love to hear from you there as well as on the phone. This episode was produced by Siona Petros. Our theme music and sound design is by Jared Paul. Matthew Miranda was live engineer this week. Our team also includes Katarina Barton, Regina Dehir, Karen Froman, Suzanne Gabber, Felice Leone, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for spending time.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.